Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest OIES podcast. This one's being brought to you from the GAS programme, and my name's James Henderson. I'm Head of GAS Research at OIES. With me today, I've got three colleagues, Jack Sharples and Mike Fullwood, who will be here to discuss the outlook for global gas markets. And I've also got Mikhail Maidan, who's Head of China Research at OIES, who's going to talk about the outlook for Chinese gas demand in the second half of the podcast. Welcome to you all. First up, let me turn to you, Jack, and start with some of our traditional questions as we look at the global gas market. Let's start with Russian supply into Europe. It's been pretty flat over the past few months, but what's the situation since we last wrote about this back in January?
The daily flows, as you say, are remaining pretty flat. Europe is currently getting about 60 to 70 million cubic meters per day, very much within the corridor of 40 to 70 million cubic meters a day that we've seen since Nord Stream was closed in September. As I would imagine it, this is very much driven by Gazprom's European counterparties and their daily offtake nominations. So I would expect that flat level will pretty much continue for the next several months. I think one thing that is interesting to note, though, is to take a half step back and look at the big picture for Q1. And in fact, up to the most recent data, the 11th of April is what we have. Between the 1st of January and the 11th of April, we got about 6 BCM of Russian gas. Now, last year, that figure was 30 BCM, and the year before, that figure was 42 BCM. So I think the thing to note here is that Europe has lost an awful lot of Russian gas. And actually, that year-on-year decline is likely to continue into Q2, based on the decline in Russian daily flows that we saw last summer.
Okay, thanks, Jack. And well, thank you also for prompting me to date the podcast, which I forgot yet again to do. So we're recording on the 13th of April, just for anyone who's worried about some of the prices and volumes we're going to talk about. Jack, so Russian flows flat, Norwegian flows, North African flows from Azerbaijan, other pipeline imports. What's going on there?
Well, with Norway, it's rather business as usual, let's say. So apart from a dip in the second half of January, the first quarter has seen Norwegian supply generally at between 320 and 350 million cubic meters a day, with 350 being our estimation of the upper limit of what's really possible from the Norwegian system. So quite reassuring, I would say. One thing that is interesting is that with the new LNG regas capacity in the Netherlands and Germany, it did seem to be less urgent to send Norwegian pipeline gas to the UK for re-export to Northwest Europe. And that was reflected in lower flows then from the UK to the EU, to the Netherlands and to Belgium via the BBL and interconnector. So indeed, we saw no BBL flows from the end of November through into the end of March and reduced flows on the interconnector. But that situation has reversed since the 1st of April, and we're now seeing flows from the UK to continental Europe at their full capacity. Elsewhere, it's pretty much no news is good news, really. Flows from North Africa seem to be fairly stable, still below the physical pipeline capacity available. For Q1 as a whole, last year we got about 8.5 BCM from North Africa in the first quarter. This year it's about 7.5 BCM, so a bit of a year-on-year decline. And then finally, Azerbaijan flows remaining very much flat, just over 30 million cubic meters per day, and long may that continue.
Jolly good. So a pretty benign picture there. Mike, you know, one of the things we highlighted in our first quarterly of 2023 was that we need to follow clearly the global LNG market, which has been so important to Europe over the past 12 months, and particularly, you know, FIDs and new projects coming online. So what's going on in the global LNG market then at the moment?
Yes, thank you, Jim. Yeah, as you said, at the beginning of the year, we were sort of projecting maybe a 4-4.5% increase in LNG supply, which works out on a monthly basis about 2.4 BCM. There's quite a lot of confusion about numbers on LNG supply. I was listening to a webinar yesterday or a summit yesterday, and somebody said there's going to be no increased LNG supply this year, which is not really right. I think what they're referring to, there's going to be no new projects come online this year, which is sort of correct, except maybe towards the end of the year. there's quite a big ramp up from projects which came on last year, like Coral, which came on right at the end of last year, the Mozambique one, Calcasieu Pass, which came on in the early part of last year, Freeport coming back on. So when you add all that up and a full year out of Norway, we're looking at sort of a 4.5% increase in supply. So what we're looking at is monitoring this supply rise through the year. It's expected to be lowish in the first quarter. We had about 1.4 BCM a month in the first quarter. And the actual outturn was below this, only about 0.4 BCM a month. And that was that was measured using the Kepler data on when the supply arrives at an import terminal. So it was below the target, although it was above last year's Q1 2022 level of supply. But if we're looking at the amount of LNG leaving export terminals, that showed quite a big increase, Q1 23 over Q1 2022. Obviously, it takes a while for those LNGs to get to the market. So I think looking in Q2, we could expect to see quite a big increase in effective supply as all this supply in Q1 starts to arrive at the terminals. So we're looking actually, I think, probably to be on target for this 4.5% increase in LNG supply as we sort of go through the year. We've seen a little bit lower supply from North America, in part year on year, because obviously Freeport was on in the early part of last year, not on the early in Q1 2023. But that's expected to sort of unwind, and we'll see higher volumes from the US for the year as a whole. So the supply situation is looking pretty much on target, I would think, for the increase we're expecting.
Okay, it sounds encouraging. And obviously quite a lot of LNG on the water then now.
Absolutely.
Good. The other topic that we raised, not on the supply side, but on the demand side as critical for this year, was Asian demand. We're going to talk to Mikhail about China a bit later and the outlook for 23. But give us the overview of what's been happening with Asian demand in the first quarter.
We were expecting the total Asian demand, including China, India, and the emerging markets, to grow between 10 and 15 BCM this year. Mikhail will talk about China, and some of that was China sort of rebounding back, Southeast Asia continuing to grow, and possibly some recovery in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, as prices have sort of come off. What actually happened in the first quarter is China remained below Q1 2022, although in part that's because January 2022 was very high in China. But the average China numbers are running above the second half of last year. Southeast Asia continued to show some growth, but Japan was down sort of quite a bit. So actually Asia LNG demand in total was below the expected increase of about 1 BCM a month, and was actually below Q1 2022. So what we're seeing there, therefore, is the sort of widening of the more supply and less Asian demand. And also, if we're looking at the wider field, Central South America, it's got a lot wetter in Brazil. It's got a lot more hydro again. And Brazilian LNG imports are down quite a lot compared to last year. So overall, in the sort of the LNG market, there's in effect more LNG available to come to Europe because supply is rising faster than demand outside Europe. And that's what we've seen, more LNGs come to Europe in Q1 2023.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, we're going to talk about prices in a sec, but I'm already feeling that a kind of negative outlook for prices is where we're going here. But let's come back to that in a sec. Jack, let me come back to you. Mike's mentioned Europe. Let's talk about European demand a bit, but I know you look at in terms of, you know, implied demand from looking at total supply. So what's been happening with total supply into Europe and therefore implied demand?
Well, I think a good place to start is to put a number on what we might consider normal for Q1. So between 2017 and 2019, that was in a range of 160 to 170 BCM. Obviously, we dipped in Q1 2020 with COVID, but in Q1 2021, we were back bang in the middle of that range, about 165 BCM. So that's what we might consider normal. We already saw a 9% drop in year-on-year in Q1 2022 that took us down to just over 150 BCM. And then in Q1 2023, we saw another 14% drop year on year that took us down to just over 130 BCM. So we are about 20% below or about sort of about 35 BCM below where we were before this crisis erupted, if you like. So clearly there's been a very sharp contraction in demand that's partially been driven by, you know, relatively benign weather conditions, but also clearly a structural contraction in European demand. So that's going to become more apparent as we go forward. Obviously, the Q1 of this year was relatively mild, and Europe has benefited from that. But the fact that we managed to drive down implied gas consumption year on year is clearly reflective of, you know, a decline in demand outside gas for space heating. And that's going to become much more apparent in the next several months, because obviously as you go into the summer, Northern Europe in particular uses very little gas normally for space heating, so you haven't got much to decline from. So I think that will really determine the extent to which the European market is tight or loose in the coming months, that industrial and power sector gas demand.
Okay, I mean, so overall picture then, we've got obviously Russian supply massively down year on year. We've got other supply pretty flat. We've got lots of LNG available for Europe, and we've got European demand down. So let's come to our favourite topic, storage. You're going to have to tell me that storage is filling again and is at quite high levels, I'm sure. But you tell me the numbers.
Well, you've guessed it correctly, Jim. Yes. So the we ended winter on the 1st of April with stocks of just under 59 BCM. The low, we carried on withdrawing for a few days after that. So the low point was reached on the 6th of April. That was 58.3 BCM. By the 11th of April, the most recent data, we bounced back to 59 BCM, and we're probably going to hit the nice round number of 60 by the 16th or 17th of April. So we're already back on track to start replenishing those storage stocks. Now, the EU, in addition to having its storage target of 90% full by the 1st of October, has a series of intermediary targets. The stocks that we have are already above those targets for the 1st of May and the 1st of July. The target for the 1st of September, which is 77 BCM in storage, could be reached quite feasibly by early June. So it looks like in storage terms, we are very much running ahead of the curve based on injection rates from recent years. I should say also that between 2017 and 2022, European net storage injections during the traditional summer months, so between the 1st of April and 1st of October, totaled between 43 and 67 BCM. This year, injections of 40 BCM will be sufficient to get us back to pretty much full capacity. So again, that just gives you an illustration, really, of the extent to which we are, as I say, running ahead of the curve on storage.
So on that point, I mean, if we are heading towards potentially full storage in Europe, I was reading that Ukrainian storage is now available for selection, as it were, and has passed all the kind of qualifications necessary to be available to European customers. Do you think that's going to be something that we're looking at as we go through the summer?
Potentially. It's certainly something that we saw in 2020 when the European market was massively oversupplied and storage got full. You saw more European traders putting gas into storage. Although what was interesting then is that not much of it came back out to Europe, that a lot of it was actually sold into the Ukrainian market thereafter. But the same thing could feasibly happen again. The Ukrainians have a system whereby you can import gas into Ukraine, not pay any customs duties on those imports, put it into storage, and then make the decision whether you either pay the customs on it and sell it into the domestic market, or you simply re-export it back to Europe. At the time, what we found was the entry-exit fees on Ukraine's western border were pretty crucial in determining whether it was profitable or not to do that. So we could see a repeat of that, actually, of gas being absorbed into Ukrainian storage, but potentially contributing to Ukrainian supply later in the year rather than re-entering the European market.
Okay, well, that's certainly one to watch, because obviously, as we know, there's a lot of storage, sort of 30-odd BCM available in Ukraine. So that'd be good to watch. So, Mike, let me come back to you. I think this is going to be the least surprising question ever, but what is the impact of all this on prices, I mean, now and sort of going forward for the rest of this year?
I think when we did the quarterly back in January, we were sort of looking at the forward curve for TTF and JKM, and they're around about sort of $22 a million BTU, with the actuals for the last 2 to 3 months plus the current forward curve. The whole average of the year has come down by about a third. So we're sort of $15, $16, and the forward curve is at $13, $14 for them both. So, yeah, we described this sort of a benign outlook at the beginning of the year. And if there is such a word, it's even more benign now, I guess, is the quote on that. I think, what we talked about tells the story: more LNG supply, less LNG demand outside Europe, weak European demand. And even though we're losing year on year, sort of 40 BCM or so of Russian imports, because storage, as Jack has pointed out, is already so relatively full, we don't need that to refill storage. So what we're looking at is that even with a possibly slower fill of storage than last year, people are talking about storage possibly being full in Europe by sometime in August. And on that sort of very sort of benign outlook, that does assume things sort of carry on as they are, with weaker LNG demand outside Europe, supply continuing, and Russia flows continuing as they are. Then, under that sort of scenario, it's possible we could actually see single digit prices in dollars a million BTU this year, which would be remarkable. Obviously, on the other hand, there's downside risks as well. China demand could pick up a lot more strongly, could have supply problems, Russia could cut off gas supplies. So the market is still relatively tight, but in the very short term, we could see much lower prices. But also, if something goes wrong, prices could rebound back very, very strongly, and $20 or above again, we could easily see that. So uncertainty, I think, is the key word. There's a probably 25% probability we could see single-digit prices sometime later this year.
Well, I never thought I'd hear that from Mike Fullwood in the 12 months after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But yeah, single-digit prices, you heard it here first. Okay, you mentioned China there and being one of the big uncertainties. So, Mikhail, let me come to you. You've written a very nice essay for the Quarterly on the outlook for Chinese gas demand in 2023. And of course, we've all been focused on what's going to happen when the lockdowns around COVID ended, which they now have. So let me just start with that. I mean, is it the case now that the COVID lockdowns are completely over and that the Chinese economy is back up and running at 100%?
COVID lockdowns have been unwound, that we do know for sure, and there are unlikely to be any more restrictions. The economy seems to be back up and running. I mean, from what we see on mobility and certainly on international travel, a lot of things are back. I think two slight caveats. One is that the Chinese economy has been sealed off from the world for the past 3 years, and there have been logistical issues. But actually, travel within China, consumption has continued. Right? We've had bouts of lockdowns, and the famous ones were in Shanghai and others for a couple of months. But throughout the past 2-3 years, actually life inside of China has been relatively normal. So from that base, we are opening up even more and improving even more. But there is also still an element of, Mike said, uncertainty. I think what we're using for China now is more wait and see, right? We've had a new government, and we do have all these questions around how long does it last? How strongly can the economy pick up? And what is the government really signaling right now?
Okay, well, on that point then, I mean, you make the point that there's a very great focus on the economy and growth. So what was in the recent budget? What are the GDP kind of targets this year? And what are the key drivers behind the economic growth as you see it?
It's really been all about economic growth. And it's a pretty sharp transformation. It wasn't just a U-turn on COVID, right? In China, there's been a crackdown on construction, on tech, which is a big sort of driver of the private sector. All of that has been reversed, suggesting that the government does really want to spur growth. However, the GDP growth target for the year was set at around 5%, which is still strong considering that last year we had 3% GDP growth. But there were expectations in the market going into the parliamentary session in March, where the government issues all these targets, that we'd get even 6% growth, sort of that there was a lot of potential for the Chinese economy to rebound strongly. And actually what the government has come out has said feels a bit more cautious. And that is a realization that there are external headwinds with a looming recession in Europe and uncertainty about the global outlook, both economically and geopolitically. Concerns about local government finances and how much they can actually pour into economic recovery. And this question of confidence, of consumer confidence, of, you know, will the construction sector and the real estate sector rebound so strongly? And then will consumers buy into this? So the government has kind of said, economy, we want growth, but everything within the targets, monetary and fiscal, suggests that they're really hoping that just by reversing the policies, U-turn, again, real estate crackdown, we will get that growth. So it is a little bit of a mixed bag, and we just don't know if that growth is going to come from, you know, what we've seen in the past, a lot of infrastructure, which, again, the government hasn't really given local officials the firepower to do, or consumption, which the government would like to become the driver of growth in China. But we're just not clear that there's enough confidence for consumers to go out and spend so much again, and that they actually have that income and that available sort of spending. So it is a little bit of a mixed bag and a cautious picture. And I think where we are a little bit more conservative, or again, slightly more cautious, we think the government will reach its around 5% GDP growth target. But right now, it's hard to see them overshooting. Now, we could, of course, see a weak H1, a weak first half of the year, and then the government really gets into overdrive to try and spur economic activity, and then we get a really strong rebound in the second half of the year.
Okay, and what are the implications of that sort of mixed picture for energy demand overall? What's the outlook there?
So the first thing to say is that that's a very volatile outlook, because even in the first half of the year, buyers of energy, refiners, gas buyers weren't ready for a big increase in demand. Now they're seeing a lull. So a lot of kind of, again, wait and see, but unclear how to prepare for this kind of economic outlook. But in terms also, you know, the China Electricity Council is forecasting a 6% growth in power demand this year. And power demand has pretty much risen in line with economic activity. But again, it's the makeup of growth. If we get more consumer-led demand, mobility, petrochemicals, you know, that's very kind of oil, coal, obviously, for the power sector, a little bit less so for gas, actually, because gas is very much driven by industrial consumption in China. And we can talk about that in detail a bit later. Conversely, if we get more infrastructure spend, and again, the kind of historical boom cycles that we've had in China, that's typically coal intensive and also quite gas intensive. But it's a very open question, again, for energy. I mean, it is, I think, interesting to note that CNPC, the biggest oil and gas company in China, its forecast for gas demand growth this year is 5%, or roughly 19 BCM. So been relatively cautious.
Okay. I mean, so you've mentioned this sort of question about whether growth is going to be driven by infrastructure or consumption. I mean, I presume this has quite a big impact. I mean, you've already touched on it, on the outlook for gas demand. So talk us through which sectors could drive gas demand, where you're expecting the most growth in 2023.
And that's an area that's a bit of a black box, to be fair. We're doing a lot of research right now, trying to unpack some of those sectoral drivers, understand, both work through the limited data that we have, and of course, the price elasticity and the price sensitivities, for which, again, there is very, very little data. But what we do know based on government data, first of all, is that industry is the biggest in industry, and commercial sectors are the biggest consumers of gas in China. Now, within that industrial sector, actually, a big part is oil and gas extraction, refining, chemicals. That's roughly half of industrial consumption, or 70 to 80 BCM. Now, last year, refining and chemicals were very weak. This year, again, oil demand growth is expected to grow quite strongly. Even the majors have come out and said it. Refining, we've got new refineries starting up, we've got refining activity picking up, new petrochemical plants. Already in southern China, there seems to be a bit of pull on gas for refining and chemicals. So that is likely to be a big boost. And probably the price sensitivity there is relatively limited. I mean, these are sort of big, heavy industries that presumably get some of their gas supplied sort of internally through the oil and gas companies, so might be less sensitive, certainly to spot gas price movements. The other big industrial consumer is smelting sort of metals, ferrous, non-ferrous metals. That depends more closely, that's more closely related to the real estate sector and to construction activity and whether or not we get a big infrastructure boom.
Okay, I mean, let's talk a little bit as well, if we may, about the power sector and particularly about coal to gas switching. I think there's been a slight change in policy in the Chinese government around the whole issue of coal to gas switching because of energy security. Is that right? I mean, what can you tell us about the role of coal going forward and what that the implications are for gas?
So coal to gas switching, I think, is important both in industry and in the power sector. Right? The big coal to gas switch that happened in 2017, 2018 was industrial, commercial, residential users. So I think we have to distinguish between there's a base load of industrial demand, that as that demand comes back, gas consumption comes back with it. New coal to gas switching, both in industry and certainly in power, is something that the government is actively discouraging now on supply security grounds. That was a very interesting take from the government work reports, again, the kind of big speeches that are issued in March at the parliamentary session. The message was a little bit all energy, we want everything, but be careful about gas because of supply security constraints. So that was, I think, a very interesting point from the government, and new coal to gas switching, certainly in industry, is unlikely to take place. In the power sector, again, we have to remember gas is 6% of power generation, of installed capacity, even less of power generation. And so there are fewer incentives for new coal to gas switching, especially as the government has been emphasizing coal and supply security. It's been increasing coal production. It's planning on adding 70 gigawatts of coal-fired capacity this year alone. So that should really support the kind of baseload power demand. The exception to that is the provinces that are heavily reliant on gas in their power mix. And those are the southern provinces, such as Guangdong, that has sort of 30% gas in power. And those provinces also depend on hydropower from neighboring provinces such as Yunnan and Sichuan. Sichuan, if you remember, had droughts last year. So hydro levels are already low coming into this year. And so there's a concern that Guangdong won't be able to get enough, or that those hydro-producing provinces won't have enough hydro to deliver to Guangdong province. If we add to that a strong recovery in economic activity, in industrial activity this summer, if we get a hot summer, a lot of heating demand, then we could get a big spike in power consumption. But that's very localized and very specific. Sort of the bigger picture for power sector demand is a limited role for gas.
Okay. And what about residential? I mean, there's been some significant growth in residential. I'm assuming it's not all weather related, but is any of it weather related? What's the underlying story in residential?
Residential has really been a story of strong growth. If you look at the data back, we're looking at 10 years of 10% annual growth. But we're still talking about a sector that accounts for 50, 60 BCM of consumption. Because prices are subsidized by the government, consumers, sort of residential users, just use the gas for cooking and heating. And as China continues to urbanize, we are going to see more gas demand in residential use. That's sort of a base load of demand going forward that I think continues. And that is one of the sort of bigger, stronger areas of demand growth. But second to those are industrial and power sector demand. And again, of course, industrial consumption, 160, 170 BCM, if that grows at 5%, it is much more significant in volume terms than residential demand growth of 10%.
You mentioned overall demand growth, a Chinese forecast of around 19 BCM for 2023. I think in your essay, you mentioned a range of 20 to 25 BCM for demand growth in 23. Correct me if I'm wrong, but how's that going to be supplied? How's that growth going to be met? Let's start with domestic supply. What's happening with domestic supply this year?
So absolutely, our numbers are 20 to 25 BCM. The 19 BCM I quoted was CNPC's outlook. This is our forecast based on the world gas model. Supplies, the expectation is another strong year of domestic production. We had 12 BCM growth last year, and a similar number is expected this year. So that will provide a big sort of baseline for supplies. In addition to that, Power of Siberia continues to ramp up, and from kind of official estimates of what we've heard, It's expected to increase by another 7 BCM. Now, our colleague Vitaly Ermakov in Russia keeps cautioning that we have to look at the compressor stations and that maybe that 7 BCM is the kind of upper limit of potential growth. But we're looking at 5 to 7 BCM of additional pipeline flows from Russia.
And what about from Central Asia? Are we still looking at growth there? What's the story from Kazakhstan, for example?
Central Asia has been relatively flat, and obviously Central Asia is the black box, the kind of line D, will it ever happen? And there's talk of it happening, but then nothing seems to materialize, and obviously a line D won't change balances this year. Kazakhstan is an interesting one. There was an agreement, sort of there were these little agreements signed in 2017 and then renewed in 2019. There's been 5 BCM flowing from Kazakhstan, but that last deal that was signed is supposed to end in the winter of 23-24. We have no indication on whether it's being renewed, renegotiated, if it ends before the winter or after the winter. So that's a big one to watch, because we could potentially lose 5 BCM of pipeline gas to China.
Okay, so doing a bit quick bit of mental maths, we've got about 20-25 BCM of demand growth. We've got 12 BCM from domestic supply, 5-7 from Russia. Question mark, 5 from Kazakhstan, will that go down? Leaves us, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 BCM required from LNG. So are new contracts going to meet that demand? What's the situation? What's China done around LNG imports for this year?
So new contracts are probably going to meet most of that. As you know, China's been very busy out in the market signing new SPAs, new long-term LNG contracts. We have calculated that between 2021 over 2021 and 2022, they've signed close to 55 million tons of new contracts. Now, around 20 million tons of those started up last year, and we've got 4 million tons starting up in 23. So the kind of contractual basis should be enough to meet China's LNG demand. That does mean that sort of incremental LNG imports this year are 6 to 8, maybe even 10 BCM. But where we are trying to sort of make a bit of a distinction is that that is unlikely to be spot cargo. So if there is kind of a competition for spot cargoes, China is unlikely to be a big player in the spot market and one that's sort of contending with Europe, if the benign outlook changes, for those spot volumes.
Okay, and indeed, might it be a seller of spot volumes, or do you think that's unlikely?
I think it could very well be a seller of spot volumes, or of its sort of contracted volumes if it doesn't have the need. Last year we saw it, you know, making a good profit on some of its existing contracts, and there's no reason it shouldn't behave that way this year. I think if you look back at it in terms of oil and increasingly gas, the Chinese kind of companies and traders have become savvier about sort of playing the market and maximizing profits on available contracts. And so I think they are very likely to do that. The other point, however, and I think what we're going to see is an interesting dichotomy this year of China both buying and selling potentially. You know, we talked about potential summer demand, and if there's a crunch, then we could see China coming into the market for spot volumes. If there is a need, be it in the summer or in the winter, based on sort of supply security grounds, China will compete with Europe for prices if it has to. But again, we think that's sort of localized and very short term. At the same time, there could be opportunistic buying. What we hear from the market in China is that at under $15 per MMBTU, industrial users do come back into the market and look for LNG supplies. It's not our base case because all the signals are sort of pointing towards you don't really need gas. But if indeed we have single-digit gas prices, some of the tier two buyers, some of the industrial consumers in China may well come into the market and try to soak up some of those cargoes and volumes. But again, that's all pretty localized and pretty small.
Okay, well, it's a fascinating picture. Thanks, Mikhail. That's really interesting. And obviously, when put together with the analysis from Jack and Mike, certainly points to, you know, continuing relatively low prices in 23, but obviously lots of moving parts to watch. If you'd like more detail on all the analysis that you've heard discussed today, then the latest Gas Quarterly will be published on the OIES website on Monday, April the 17th. So look out for that and download it if you want all the background information. But with that, thank you, Jack. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mikhail, for your fascinating insights today. Thank you to all our listeners for tuning in again. Take care of yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.